Hello, it's Thursday the 2nd of April. I'm John Dennis. Today, G20, the most powerful leaders of the world meet in London to discuss coordinated action to tackle the global recession.
All of us here in London have the responsibility to act with a sense of urgency, and every nation that will be participating has been affected by a crisis that has cost us so much in terms of jobs, savings, and the economic security.
A breakthrough on the fringes of the summit, with Russia and the United States agreeing to talks on reducing their nuclear weapons.
It does look like there's a head of steam, there's political will on both sides.
And in other news, head teachers pour scorn on the latest primary school league tables.
So there's about 164 schools with partial results. There's 33 schools which are just marked missing in the tables. That's three times as many as last year.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, Bill Overton with the news and the papers.
More G20 demonstrations are expected in central London today after protests carried on late into last night. A man died yesterday after collapsing within a police cordon set up to contain the crowds. Officers say bottles were thrown at medics trying to help him. The day of action, which began peacefully, saw numerous arrests for public disorder offences and smashed windows at a city branch of Royal Bank of Scotland. Today, activists are expected to try to disrupt trade at the London Stock Exchange, and anti-war protests are planned near the Excel Centre in Docklands, where the summit itself is taking place. Inside the conference hall, world leaders will concentrate on how to revive the world economy, now in its worst state since the 1930s. Gordon Brown's been battling to prevent a rift with the French and Germans over how to confront the crisis. The US and UK favour more government spending, while the French and Germans want financial reform. German Chancellor Angela Merkel says this is the time to give capitalism a conscience. More on the G20 in a moment. Plus, of course, you can keep up with all the developments with The Guardian's comprehensive coverage online today, with everything from detailed analysis to Twitter updates from our reporters out on the streets. Just go to guardian.co.uk/G20. In other news, the search continues in the North Sea off Aberdeenshire for those still missing after a helicopter crash. The aircraft was returning from a BP oil field with 16 people on board. 8 were confirmed dead yesterday, and Scotland's First Minister, Alex Salmond, says the outlook for the others is bleak. Authorities in the US have seized the multi-million dollar Florida beach home of the disgraced financier Bernard Madoff. His yacht and a motorboat have also been confiscated. Last month, Madoff pleaded guilty to all 11 charges relating to a £35 billion investment fraud. The Prime Minister of Malaysia has resigned. Abdullah Badawi is criticised for failing to fulfil his promises to eradicate corruption, reform the judiciary and strengthen the police and civil service. His deputy, Najib Razak, who's also been dogged by controversy, will take over. And in sport, England have made it 5 wins out of 5 in their qualifying group for the World Cup, with a 2-1 win over Ukraine. John Terry secured a late win, scoring after 85 minutes. Scotland took a 2-1 victory too, with Ross McCormack and Stephen Fletcher scoring to set up a vital World Cup qualifying win over Iceland. Now for a look at the papers, and it's pretty much blanket coverage of the G20 protests and the arrival of various world leaders ahead of today's summit. Love and hate, says the Mail, with one picture of Gordon Brown directing an admiring smile at Barack Obama and another of police confronting a bloodied protester. Deal or no deal, asks the Independent, highlighting the divisions between Brown and Obama and Merkel and Sarkozy. Obama's nuclear overture is the leader in the Times, which reports on talks between the US and Russian presidents on slashing nuclear stockpiles. The paper says the two have promised a fresh start, which could lead to legally binding arms reductions. The Sun reports on Barack Obama's gift to the Queen. My husband and iPod is the headline there. Apparently the gadget contains photos and a video of Her Majesty's last state visit to America in 2007. The paper says it shows the president's thoughtfulness, as the monarch is known to be a fan of iPods and owns one which can contain 100,000 songs. The Mirror, meanwhile, focuses on the First Lady. Michelle is a fashion belle, it says, with pictures of her numerous outfits throughout the day. And, of course, all this talking must have meant world leaders had worked up a healthy appetite by the time they arrived for dinner at Downing Street last night. And The Guardian reports that they were treated to a culinary trip around the British Isles with Scottish salmon, Welsh lamb, Irish soda bread, Jersey Royals and Bakewell tart on the Jamie Oliver prepared menu. Keep up to date with all the breaking news throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
World leaders are gathered in London to discuss ways to resolve the financial crisis, which Barack Obama has said is the most severe since the Second World War. Yesterday at Downing Street, Gordon Brown stood alongside President Obama and said G20 leaders were within a few hours of agreeing a global deal for economic recovery. But within a few hours, the leaders of France and Germany staged their own press conference, at which Nicolas Sarkozy and Angela Merkel reiterated their opposition to a fresh coordinated stimulus. The US president has played down the differences, but I asked our chief political correspondent, Nicolas Watt, whether they could be overcome.
Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president, even before he arrived in London, talked about how he would adopt that very familiar French diplomatic tactic known as the empty chair. But I'm afraid to say I think it was a bit of an empty gesture, because I think you'll find that the French chair will be filled throughout the whole of the summit today by Nicolas Sarkozy. I think that what the French president was doing was playing to a domestic audience, an uneasy domestic audience, that this summit is obviously taking place in London, dominated by the British, and that the Americans, even though it's Barack Obama in office, French always a little wary of an American president, worried that it would be dominated by Britain and the United States, and he was saying, I will make sure that our key interests, which are to introduce much tighter regulation of financial markets, that I will be doing battle on that. And that was why yesterday evening we saw this joint press conference between Nicolas Sarkozy and Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, at the German embassy in London, saying we have these red lines and these red lines must be met. Usually when leaders talk about red lines, and the country that normally talks about red lines is Britain in its negotiations with the European Union. Normally when leaders talk about red lines and how they must be absolutely met, you can be pretty sure that they've already been met. So I don't think we'll be seeing too many temper tantrums and too many walkouts at the summit in London today.
France and Germany are calling for a new era of global regulation of banks on executive bonuses, hedge funds and offshore tax havens. Is there anything there that Gordon Brown and Barack Obama disagree with?
Well, I think there are disagreements. Where there's disagreement is where the emphasis should be. France and Germany are saying we think the emphasis should be on tighter regulation. Britain and the United States say, yeah, absolutely, in favour of tighter regulation. But you know what you really should be doing is fiscal stimuli measures, because that's what really, really boosts an economy. So there are differences on the emphasis. But on these specific areas, these five red lines on the remuneration of traders, on tax havens, on things like securitisation, I think you'll find that the demands that France and Germany have made are really not impossible to meet. And on things like tax havens, well, you know, Gordon Brown has been talking almost of nothing else in the last few weeks about the importance of cracking down on tax havens. So don't think there's going to be much of a problem there.
Now, Barack Obama visited Downing Street yesterday, and there was much warmer praise for Gordon Brown from Barack Obama than we saw when the Prime Minister visited Washington last month.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? You almost felt that Barack Obama had sort of decided to sort of turn on the charm, that Gordon Brown was sort of denied a joint press conference with Barack Obama in the White House when he went there last month, that Gordon Brown went to incredible efforts to find a present for the new president that sort of summed up the Anglo-American special relationship. And what did Gordon Brown get in return? He got a DVD collection. Barack Obama went out of his way, not just going into Downing Street, having the press conference in the Foreign Office, but also talking in glowing terms about Gordon Brown, and indeed in glowing terms about Britain and how marvellous the Queen is. So yes, you really got the impression that he was slightly trying to make up for a bit of ground lost in the last month or so.
So do you expect Gordon Brown to be happy at the end of today, Nick?
Gordon Brown has decided that the G20 summit is a key moment in his premiership. He's also decided that his relationship with Barack Obama is important for him, and they are coming together in London. But while there may be smiles, while there may be sun, while there may be praise from Barack Obama, what will matter is what is agreed at the G20 summit and what is its impact. And if we're finding that the world economy is not picking up by the summer, not picking up by the end of the year, then all those smiles and all those warm words may not count for a great deal as we head into the general election in the spring, summer next year.
Nicolas Watt, well, the diplomacy began well before the start of the summit. There was an announcement yesterday that Russia and the US are to discuss reducing their nuclear arsenal. The negotiations will be the first such talks for more than a decade. Presidents Dmitry Medvedev and Barack Obama met yesterday at the US Embassy near Regent's Park before announcing the discussions. Julian Borges, our diplomatic editor, he said it was a significant moment.
Well, it really means that nuclear disarmament is back on in earnest. The two leaders have agreed to restart talks on deep strategic cuts in their nuclear arsenals in time for December of this year, when the existing treaty governing those stockpiles expires, the START treaty expires December the 5th. They've committed themselves to coming up with a new treaty with deeper cuts in time for that.
What are the main bones of contention that they'll have to tackle?
Well, what they have to get out of the way is the disagreement over missile defence, which has really muddied the water in terms of nuclear disarmament for years. Now, either there will be a separate deal on the US missile defence system, maybe it will be slowed down or even shelved or made conditional on Iranian progress in building missiles, something like that, to get it off the table and just to concentrate both sides on numbers of weapons. Now, there may be problems over the issues of verification, and these have dogged nuclear disarmament talks for years too, but it does look like there's a head of steam, there's a political will on both sides to get new and deeper cuts in time for December.
And both countries, in the face of the recession, will be wanting to cut spending on nuclear arms.
Yeah, so this helps. It's fairly expensive to maintain nuclear arms. Cutting the stockpiles helps save money.
Now, America wants Russia to use its influence with Iran. We've also seen diplomatic moves at the G20 summit between the US and Iran. What does America want Russia to do?
America wants Russia to make clear to Iran that if Iran doesn't suspend uranium enrichment, as the Security Council has demanded, that there will be serious consequences. And it wants Russia to demonstrate that the international community is united over this, and this won't be possible to split the major powers over it. Now, up to now, Russia has been reluctant to go along with more and deeper sanctions, and has encouraged the US to offer more to Iran as a reward for suspending uranium. Now, the US has done that, so it's turning to Russia and saying, OK, we've done our side of the bargain, now do yours.
And the announcement that Russia and the US were making movement on nuclear disarmament came on the fringes of the G20 summit in London. Are we likely to see more announcements as the world leaders gather in London?
Well, I suppose you can't have this many world leaders in one place and not create some kind of diplomatic progress. The fact of when two leaders meet, they like to come out with something, and they like to have a piece of paper at the end of it. And that is a driver for diplomatic progress on a range of issues. But this is pretty strong stuff. This is probably about as strong as we'll see in terms of a central issue, nuclear proliferation, two major powers that haven't been getting on, Russia and the US, getting something done and making quite concrete agreements, including an agreement that President Obama will visit Moscow in July. And it's hoped that by then a treaty or a framework of a treaty will be ready.
Julian Borgia. Well, as G20 leaders prepared for today's summit, anti-globalisation protesters staged mass demonstrations yesterday in London. There was severe disruption in the City of London, where anarchists smashed up a branch of the Royal Bank of Scotland. Protesters converged on the Bank of England, some of them dressed in colourful costumes, as The Guardian's Alok Jha reports.
My name's Harry, and I'm protesting for the smaller individual in Britain, who has been left, for want of another expression, held with their pants down, as the government bails out the banks for billions of dollars. But where's the money going to help your struggling baker, your struggling butcher, your small marketing companies, your architecture companies? These are the people who pay their taxes and keep this country together, and the money's not filtering down to them. You're bailing out the big boys, but you're leaving the little boys to sink.
And so why are you dressed in the way you are? Can you just describe what you're dressed as?
Well, I'm dressed as Death, as it were, with my skeleton toes, my black hood, my scythe, and I did have a mask, which the police took off me at the underground station, under the guise that I was hiding my face and I may be here to cause trouble, which I'm not sure whether that's entirely legal or not, but it probably is a failure of when I last marched. I haven't marched in 10 years. Last time I came out was for the Criminal Justice Bill marches to protect our human rights and our own individual civil rights. And it's pretty much a case we failed then, and that's why I can come off a tube and they can say, take off my mask, I'll lose my deposit on this that I've rented today. But death as a figure represents the death of the economy, death of the English pound, and it's a very morbid outlook, death, and that's what it's going to be for a lot of people. It's going to be very tough, it's going to be very dark, it's going to be very morbid in the years to come.
My name's Dave Tucker, I work for War on Want, which is a UK charity based here in London.
Okay, and so why are you holding a dead canary in a stretcher outside the Bank of England?
It's just a laugh, really. this canary is a dead canary to symbolise the death of Canary Wharf and the current financial system, which we feel has failed hundreds of millions, in fact billions of people across the world who are faced with food crisis, environmental crisis, climate crisis, and making an already unbearable situation even worse. And for why? For the greed of a few people based here in London and other financial sectors.
That's quite a lot of different issues to deal with there, I mean, climate change, financial stuff, all of that. Do you think that it's a good idea that all these people come together?
Yeah, I think it's a massively important thing, because what has traditionally happened is all of these protests and all these campaigns, if you like, have grown up separately, but essentially we're all recognising that they are part of the same thing. They have the same roots and they have the same solutions. So I'm totally for all of these protests and different issues joining together in the service of finding a new system that puts people before profit.
And so what's happening to the canary today? What are you going to do with it?
We're going to walk around, get taken pictures of a lot by so far, and then we're hoping it's going to have another outing later in the year for the next G20 meeting or perhaps a G8 in Italy.
Alok Jar reporting. Great to have an interview with Death on the show. Also on The Guardian's website, John Harris on the importance of public libraries. That's at guardian.co.uk/comment is free to have your say. Harry and Wills, Patrick Barkham on a tale of two modern princes at guardian.co.uk/monarchy. And Barney Rone on Alan Shearer's return to Newcastle United. Can the Messiah save the day? guardian.co.uk/football. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in today's Guardian Daily, celebrity chef Gary Rhodes on teaching children to cook.
I love writing cookery books. I love doing live cookery shows. And that's more not because you're trying to be this, look at me, I'm a celeb. It's moreover, look at this dish. Doesn't it excite you?
But first, primary school league tables were published yesterday. But head teachers say they can't be trusted because they're based on unreliable SAT test scores. Polly Curtis is our education editor.
They're saying take them with a pinch of salt, and that's because of the multiple problems the whole SAT system has had this year, and it's the SAT's results that feed into the tables and on which every school in the country is rated.
I mean, just to recap, what happened with the SAT's results?
They got a new firm in, it's an American firm called ETS, and they basically didn't run it and it all fell apart and the results were late. These league tables were meant to be out 3 months ago. They're delayed by those problems. The firm was sacked. The government agency that was responsible was disbanded. There were lots of resignations over it and it was a big mess.
Now, the government insists that the big mess hasn't adversely affected the tables and that they are reliable and rigorously checked. Who's right here?
Well, there's two views here. One is the fact that for the first time, more schools than ever didn't have data or had missing data in this. So there's about 164 schools, according to the QCA, that don't have data in this this that are excluded.
The QCA is the authority that monitors
the government agency, Qualification and Curriculum Authority. So there's about 164 schools with partial results. There's 33 schools which are just marked missing in the tables. That's three times as many as last year. And when we went to congratulate the top school in the whole country, they said they stopped us and said, don't, we shouldn't be there. The results are wrong. We've spent the last year trying to have these results changed, and we shouldn't be top of the table. So it doesn't really kind of do the whole system any favours if the person at the top of the table, the school at the top of the table, is shouldn't be there.
And teachers are threatening to boycott next year's SAT. Is there a future for SAT?
Probably not in this form. And with SATs, there are two things going on here. There's last year, all the problems of last year, and then there's just the ongoing complaints about the SAT system. And that complaint is that they're not very useful tests. They're put to too many different purposes. So the argument is that you test a pupil to tell them how they're doing, and then you use that system, that test, to hold the school to account, and then you also use it to hold the government to account. And that puts so much pressure on the schools to do really, really well that it corrupts that child's learning. So that argument has always been the case, regardless of the problems of the last year. And I think the government increasingly does recognise that. They're not at the moment saying they're going to rush into any changes, but the furthest they go is they say this system is not set in stone, and they are trialling alternatives which are slightly more flexible tests.
Polly Curtis. And just a quick mention that you can follow Guardian Daily at Twitter, twitter.com/Guardian Daily. Well, as Jamie Oliver prepared to serve traditional British fare for the G20 leaders, the chef Gary Rhodes prepares for a new TV series hitting our screens next week, Rhodes Across the Caribbean. Gary Rhodes has championed great British food even longer than Jamie Oliver, and has the Michelin stars to prove it. He told G2's Hannah Poole about his experiences of teaching children to cook.
I want to start educating them on simple, basic ingredients that really many, many of them have never held before. Like, you know, sort of telling them. I remember doing something for an all-boys school, and I told them we're going to have spinach and goat's cheese tarts. Now, can you imagine their horrified faces when I said that? But it was getting them to understand the flavour of these ingredients. They didn't want to touch them raw. You know, they'll have a look at it. Oh, yes, point at it. But seeing how it changes during that cooking process. And all of a sudden, when they cut into that little tartlet and they're eating it, and the creaminess of the goat's cheese and how that blends with that spinach, the little hint of seasoning that was with it as well. And so this is what I like to do. And it really suddenly opens up their mind as to flavours they didn't realise they'd enjoy, and they suddenly do, and on a very healthy basis.
Whose fault do you think it is that children don't cook anymore?
I think it's just society and life has changed over the years. We find that, you know, very few people have any time anymore. You know, it's a rush. Life seems to be too much of a rush. You know, mum's out working, dad's out working. You know, in my days, it was when, you know, one was home. It was either mum at home or dad at home. There was always somebody there, and then it was out and getting to the local shops. You know, we didn't have all the you know, instant foods in those days. It's because I'm so old. But, you know, we didn't have all of those, you know, those products that it makes life easy today. So it had to be about home-cooked food. You had no choice.
It's not just that children aren't cooking, is it? I mean, there's this sort of irony where we watch anything on the television about cookery, and yet, we buy all these cookery books, but they sit on the coffee table. We don't actually cook.
Well, you know, I'm glad to say, I think it's growing within people. I think, you know, from when the cooking first started on TV, it was there purely for entertainment. There are one or two shows, no names mentioned here, that are purely for entertainment and a few words they want to hear rather than the dish they want to see. But, you know, that's part of entertainment. But there's also many good cookery shows where you can really sort of get an education on great food. And I think more and more people today are becoming a little bit more adventurous. You know, they're being a little bit more careful. And now with this sort of credit crunch, I think more people will be cooking. And it will be great then if we could be sharing that with our children. And I think if they're cooking at school, then, you know, that's got to be... They already have an enthusiasm within them. This can help be, you know, developed by the school and also by their parents.
Bearing that in mind, what do you think of the phrase celebrity chef?
Never heard of it. I don't know. I really dislike it. I'm a chef, you know. I am a professional chef. I have been for over 30 years. And yes, there are lots of nice things that go with it. You know, I enjoy, you know, cooking on television. I love it. I love writing cookery books. I love doing live cookery shows. And that's more not because you're trying to be this, look at me, I'm a celeb. It's more over, look at this dish. Doesn't it excite you? And then I love it when you get that feed from the, you know, it makes me hungry watching them. You know, when they're sort of little dribbling as I'm cooking. Can you ask for any more than that? That, for me, is the greatest pleasure of all.
Guardian Daily was produced today by Phil Maynard and Doug Harding. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.